Ariel Sharon hovers on the margin of life and death, but what is agreed is that his military political career is over. For the moment, the media are mythologizing the man. This frenzy has probably a short-lived shelf life, but while it lasts, it's all the more important to understand the real deeds and ambitions of Sharon. To help us in this task, we've contacted Ali Abu Nima in Chicago. Ali is one of the co-founders of and a regular contributor to Electronic Intifada. Electronic Intifada is the most thorough and reliable website in English on matters relating to Palestine and Israel. Good morning, Ali, and thank you for joining us again on Red Eye.
Good morning, Mordechai. It's a pleasure.
The current myth-making about Sharon reminds me of the whitewashing and saccharine tones that surrounded the death of Ronald Reagan. What do you make of this mythologizing?
It's extraordinary, the mythologizing of Sharon and the whitewashing of who he is and what he stood for and what he was doing up to the very last day of his consciousness, which is, you know, working backwards, ordering extrajudicial executions, the seizure of Palestinian land, really committing war crimes and serious violations of international law up until the day he was taken ill. But his career of murder and mayhem goes back half a century, and it's something that is well known by Palestinians, even if the rest of the world chooses to forget. And back to the 1950s, when he was in charge of the notorious Unit 101 and led attacks on Palestinian villages, and one that's particularly notorious was the attack on the village of Qibya in 1953, in which 69 Palestinian civilians, most of them women and children, were killed. And I just want to recall what the U.S. State Department said after the Qibya massacre. And it issued a statement expressing, quote, its deepest sympathy for the families of those who lost their lives. And it said that those responsible should be brought to account and that effective measures should be taken to prevent such incidents in the future. Unfortunately, instead of being brought to account, Sharon has enjoyed lifelong impunity for war crimes, not just in Qibya, but in the Gaza Strip in the early 1970s, then his invasion of Lebanon, which killed tens of thousands of Lebanese and Palestinian civilians, the massacres at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Beirut, for which an Israeli commission found him personally responsible, and the word they used was personally responsible, up to the continued crimes that we see to this very day in the occupied territories.
These kind of history of crimes of war and crimes against humanity, as you say, dating from the incidents in Qibya and through Gaza and Lebanon and on to today, were well documented, and in fact they seem to have been well publicized even within the Jewish Israeli Hebrew language media, and he certainly got his name as the bulldozer because of those kind of aggressive and racist motivated tactics. So how is the trick being performed that this man, well known for all these atrocities in the past, is now, as George Bush labeled him, a man of peace?
Well, it's for a number of reasons. It is in large part due to the complicity of foreign governments that claim to uphold international law and claim to be interested in bringing to account the perpetrators of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Let's recall that some of the survivors of Ariel Sharon's war crimes have tried to pursue him in justice. Just a few years ago, in the courts of Belgium, victims of the Sabra and Shatila massacres were successful in getting a case against him heard, which was really terrifying the Israeli authorities. But then under U.S. pressure, Belgium changed its law to prevent Belgium having jurisdiction over that. And we have seen countries like Canada, the United States, the United Kingdom, countries, again, that claim to be standing for the highest principles, colluding with Sharon, praising him. Jack Straw, the UK Foreign Secretary, delivered on the radio last week the most extraordinary paean to Ariel Sharon. You would have thought he was describing Mother Teresa. And part of this is because Sharon has pulled such an incredible bait and switch by convincing a lot of people that his so-called Gaza disengagement was part of a move towards peace rather than a part of a very aggressive effort by Israel to consolidate its territorial control over as much of Palestine as possible and to corral the Palestinians into what are effectively large concentration camps or open-air prisons, as Palestinians call them. And that while Sharon has been praised as a courageous leader for taking a few thousand settlers out of Gaza, the international community, and that includes, unfortunately, more and more the Canadian government, which used to be much more progressive on these issues, have turned a blind eye to the massive, massive ongoing expansion of settlements in the West Bank and the construction of the apartheid wall, which was ruled, of course, illegal by the International Court of Justice. So this impunity, this collusion with Israel, is really why Sharon is being mythologized in this way. We cannot simply lay the responsibility at the door of Israel. The responsibility has to go to all of those who, while pursuing Slobodan Milosevic, while pursuing other war criminals, accused war criminals from the Balkans, while praising the trial of Saddam Hussein, have simply allowed the blood of tens of thousands of Ariel Sharon's victims to simply flow into the ground with no accountability and total impunity.
Some commentators have situated Ariel Sharon in the tradition of Israel's first prime minister, another man whose policies are much mythologized, David Ben-Gurion of the Labour Party, rather than seeing him as essentially a inheritor of the Likud Party tradition, which he was part of in recent years. What do you think of that connection between the agenda of Ben-Gurion and Ariel Sharon?
Well, they're similar in the sense that both were always committed to maximum territorial expansion of Israel. Sharon, up until his last conscious moment, Israel announced massive expansion of the settlements since the so-called Gaza disengagement, which Sharon fully approved and spearheaded. And their effort was always to control the maximum amount of land with the minimum number of Palestinians. And that has been the consistent stream through Israeli Zionist policy from the very beginning, and it hasn't changed. There are a lot of people who want to believe, who are prepared to turn a blind eye to all of this because they're looking for hope, and so they want to believe that the Gaza disengagement was the beginning of the end of this conflict rather than simply the beginning of a much more bitter and intractable phase. And all of the mythologizing of Sharon to try to make us believe that, you know, he was a great man like Yitzhak Rabin before him, that these were peacemakers, none of this is going to make any difference. Sharon's policies were not the policies of one man. They were the policies of the Israeli establishment, and they will continue no matter who replaces him, and they will continue until the world decides to confront Israeli aggression, to hold Israel accountable, to force Israel to comply with so many Security Council resolutions that lie a gathering dust on the shelf. There will be no peace unless injustice is confronted. There are a lot of people out there, Mordechai, a lot of well-meaning people who think you can get peace just by sitting around a table and singing songs and playing the guitar. It doesn't work that way. There has to be confrontation of the injustice. And when there is confrontation, people get uncomfortable, people get upset, but unfortunately we're not going to get to peace unless this apartheid system is taken on, fought, and defeated, so that all Israelis and Palestinians can finally live in peace and security.
You refer to the international community. I want to go back, accepting that point as being very vital, to the Jewish-Israeli political culture, because what seems to be undoubtedly true is that Ariel Sharon is ending his military and political career at the height of his popularity. And what does that tell us about the prospects for a authentic and viable peace movement in Jewish-Israeli society?
Well, I think that there are a lot of people in Israeli society and among North American supporters of Israel who believe that Israel can have its cake and eat it, that Israel can have international legitimacy, that it can be a Jewish state, that it can be a democracy, without really recognizing the equality and the fullness of the rights of Palestinians. So you have a lot of opinion polls that say that 60, 70, 80% of American Jews and Israelis support the Gaza disengagement, that they support a Palestinian state, that they see this as necessary for Israel's long-term future. But when you get down to the detail and ask how many are willing to support a total withdrawal from the settlements, a fair compromise over Jerusalem, the numbers collapse. So they want to have their cake and eat it, and I think it's because they've been misled by Israeli leaders for decades into believing we can build settlements and talk peace at the same time. It doesn't work that way. Throughout the years of the peace process, the Oslo process, Israel talked about peace while continuing to commit aggression, to confiscate land, to build settlements. During the years of the peace process, so-called, over 1 million Palestinian olive trees were uprooted by Israeli settlers and soldiers. More than 4,000 homes were demolished during the years of the so-called peace process. More than 100,000 people were made homeless, and hundreds of square kilometers of Palestinian land were confiscated for the exclusive use of Jews. Israelis and American Jews have to decide whether they want peace or settlements and conquest. And so far, unfortunately, the most influential parts of those communities haven't yet made up their mind about that. They don't stand up and say clearly, we condemn what Israel is doing. And now I'm talking about, of course, the leading pro-Israel organization. There are very courageous voices from within Israel and from within the North American Jewish community who have been very, very critical, and I think essential voices. But we need to hold the mainstream pro-Israel groups accountable, that they cannot keep supporting war crimes, violations of international law, and at the same time saying they want peace. It doesn't work that way.
Thank you very much, Ali, for that clarity. We appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I've been speaking with Ali Abu Nima. He's the co-founder of and writer for Electronic Intifada. And check out their website. You can find it at electronicintifada.net.